Welcome back to How to Be Queer. This is Kellum.
And this is Chris. And today we're talking to Martin Boyce about the Stonewall Riot of 1969.
And this episode is the very first in our Pride series episodes.
Woo! Martin, welcome. We would like to first, this is the best way to get started, is to have yourself introduce yourself. So give us an idea of who you are, like names, pronouns, identifiers, if you have them, and then a little synopsis about yourself. Just tell us who you are.
My name is Martin Boyce. I'm a Stonewall participant and an activist. He and him are my pronouns. And I've come to Canada to do a speaking tour, trying to get people to understand the complexities of Stonewall, but really the basic aspects. I mean, the basic aspects of Stonewall, what you were talking about, these complexities, are not new. We had these complexities in Stonewall about how to get a bunch of different groups agree on one thing. And they did. The bar was a great bar, but the complexity I understand very well.
So, you know, obviously pre-Stonewall, and even a little bit after that probably, the homosexuality was criminalized. And so it was hard to exist as a homosexual person. So what was your experience being queer back then?
Well, being queer back then, well, to be perfectly honest, and I hate to use cliches, we're talking about a tale of two cities. We're talking about, for one group, you know, the best and worst of times. The 60s, New York City was the greatest city in the world in the 60s, at least they thought so. It wasn't in the papers and it wasn't on the radio or the TV, but everybody knew it. It just had its finger on the pulse. It felt it. And this was a remarkable city, very liberal and very prosperous, sexual revolution and the pill and all these things happening at once. And it was run by a very liberal mayor who took down all the signs of prohibition about playing baseball and things in the park. And it was called Fun City. It really was a very prosperous party. And the party, the straight people, the normative people, would extend from the day into the night. But in the night, they would abandon the parks and the waterfronts and the parking lots and the cul-de-sacs. And that's where the Twilight people would come, us. And with us, since we were illegal, our camp followers, the hustlers and the blackmailers and the opportunists and the thieves, which we were acquainted with. There was nothing to do about it. That was perception. So, but prosperous. Everybody was prosperous and thus hopeful. Prosperous, not in a way of consumer ability, but prosperous in the way that dreams had been fulfilled or on their way. You know, a lot of us were starting in college. Things had changed. Language that we were using had changed. We were becoming more sophisticated. So a great underground, great gay underground had formed. Very powerful and knew how to exist or coexist or subsist with these people, but we didn't know at this time when they never mentioned us in the press or whatever, that we had a very, very great culture. We knew that. That's part of our history that we didn't let go. I mean, the muses were very kind to us and we honored the muses and we've been rewarded. You could just see in a bookshop the amount of jewels. So anyway, we had a powerful culture. That was part of the Stonewall riots, that the next step after having this kind of fulfillment was freedom. Why was it our ability or, you know, our money or anything, to put it that way, able to do what it did with just anybody else? So it was a very, very difficult period. At the same time, a prosperous period. So we're really the best and worst of both worlds, because you see, the police wanted us in jail, and the psychiatrists wanted us in lunatic asylums, and the clergy wanted us in hell. That's what it was, and that was the powers, and that's what you had to operate with, and you can operate with it. And we had proven it, except, you know, too much became too much.
So when you're kind of saying too much at the time, what was the too much? Like, what was happening that led kind of up to the Stonewall riots? How did it become too much and push you over?
Well, when you came out, one of the first things they told you was that never go to the police for anything. And they said anything, you know. And I listened, but one day, because I was young, it was 2 o'clock in the morning, I couldn't wait for the bus any longer to cross Central Park, which was dangerous. And but I was too young, and I said I could make it. I'd be quick, and I crossed the park. And I was near the gay area, and I heard a blood-curdling sound. It was really awful. And I couldn't quite shake it. I mean, I thought, you know, I should have felt that I escaped it. I was safe. That's what we thought then. But this time, I just couldn't completely shake it. Its ghost was still hanging on me as I was walked out of the park and saw a bunch of police and their cars, and they were talking. And so I went up to one of them. I said, I think you need to investigate in the park. There was a horrible thing happening in there. I heard it. And he started put his fingers on his chin and said, well, you know, where's your dog? I said, I don't have a dog. And he said, well, why were you in the, do you live around here? It was no. And the next thing was, then why are you here? And all of a sudden I had become a victim. And then all of a sudden he called everybody over to listen to this queer story. And they were in a good mood that evening. And they just opened up and let me go. But the threat was there. I knew where I stood. And I promised myself I'd never go to ever to them again. I had never anything to do with them again.
So that feeling that you had in the park, Martin, did that kind of fuel what happened at Stonewall? Because I can assume that that was a very common feeling to have from your friends and other chosen family members who experienced those things in the park. Is that kind of what fueled what happened at Stonewall?
It was incremental, you know. It was incremental because you knew friends that were lobotomized or arrested or crippled or beaten by the police. Everybody knew somebody. They didn't come around anymore and weren't talked about, but they really weren't forgotten. No, all these things incremental, all these kind of tortures, unnecessary tortures. Yeah, that led to Stonewall, of course.
What was Stonewall like? Like what? Like pre the actual riot, what was kind of happening at Stonewall? Was there like, if you don't mind kind of describing Stonewall?
Well, it was remarkable because we could dance there. It was amazing. There are two dance floors. I mean, this is unheard of. And, you know, Stonewall was known, even like the older gays said, we never had a place like this. And Stonewall had a great jukebox, great. And they had these African-American queens in front of it that were voguing to the song and was just amazing to watch. It was a show, they were really good. And there was no word yet for voguing. And the jukebox was used to answer arguments or to tell stories. Two queens would have a fight and one would play a song that would answer. And if you were hip, you could see what was going on and messages were being sent. And then all these gay people didn't particularly like each other. I mean, the A-gays in suits thought that the loud queens were bringing trouble to them. The loud queens thought that the A-gays were collaborators, but Stonewall taught us all how to be together. It taught us toleration. We really didn't have it before then.
So it kind of helped to, like Stonewall, the movement itself, you're saying, kind of helped to bring everybody together as a community?
Stonewall created a camaraderie
okay.
amongst dissident groups that had to use the bar. It was the only dancing bar. It was like, if it was Noah's Ark and it was a flood, there were two or three of every type of gay person in the whole city in that bar. It wasn't any predominance. So you had to learn to get along with everybody, waiting on the bathroom line and being annoyed by people normally. And you had to get along. But we're sharing the music and it was working. It was really working. There was a nice feeling in there. And that's what was so painful when it was smashed, you know.
So owning this bar was probably a dangerous thing for the people who owned it, right? So they, maybe a better question is, who owned the bar first?
The mafia owned the bar.
Okay.
Dangerous to them. They just owned it. But in owning it, they had to pay off the police.
Ah, okay.
It's all corruption.
Yes.
At the level you were going to Stonewall, it didn't mean anything. It didn't mean anything. It just meant you had a bar. I mean, it wasn't a moral decision on anybody's part. And certainly no protests, because they were the only people that were providing the service. And that was a service that they could do and they could make money from, and was done. There was no moral question. Something like the speakeasy, perhaps, of the 20s. The prohibition against us and the reaction.
So are you able to tell us a little bit about what was going on at Stonewall right before the riot started? And then how did the riot start?
Well, what was going on at Stonewall was a party. What was going on at Stonewall was, we not even thought about it. It was the place where you went. And I mean, I explained to you already how cool the bar was, right? Mm-hmm. And yes. So in other words, we're just living that life. We've got used to having this good bar that ended, you know, it ended so abruptly. Because, you know, one time I saw the bar when it was empty and it was just dark and black walls and it was just nothing. And it's amazing how the gay people made that space so amazing. I was quite impressed. It was almost aesthetic and it was a learning experience to look around and see what people can do to make something something.
I guess the big question is, how did Stonewall become a riot?
Well, it was the beginning of an election year, and it was going to be very, very difficult. It was the beginning of the summer, and everybody had plans for the summer, and everybody was ready and prepared and prosperous, generally, even those less prosperous were benefiting from the prosperity of others, being invited out to Fire Island. Just a summer, we needed it. It was very, very hard. At Stonewall, well, we're supposed to go into Stonewall on the night of June 28th. I was going to go to Stonewall, and I found out I couldn't get in. Long before Club 54, they had a policy of only letting whom they wanted in on the weekends. So the bar couldn't tip.
Yeah,
I mean, it wasn't high-minded ecumenicalism. It was really the idea of making money. And my friend told me, since I was a scared rag, like Boy George, and he was, he said, you're not getting in. And fine. Because New York City, and Friday night, okay. But there was this people behind me in a rush. And something about raid. Stonewall was like five doors down. But the trucks were there, the paddy wagons were there. And it was a raid in the middle of the village, in the middle of one of the most popular tourist destinations in the city. Incredible. Most of the raids I know I was in was near the waterfront where no one could watch it. And here it was. I guess they were sending a message. And but I said, now if you weren't in a raid, you had to prepare for a raid. You were always told what a raid was about, and everybody had been in one. It was a pleasant thing. But if you weren't in it, you watched it. You watched the queens come out to cheers because they loved it. And the lawyers come out with their heads, in shame and to cheers. And young people without ID were going to the paddy wagons. And a certain quota had to go to the paddy wagon and all sorts of things. You see, and you had this kind of schadenfreude, you know, this kind of thing like, at least it's not me. And that's how we used to be. It victimized ourselves, we really did, you know, because it was an amazing show. But it was a very sad show, a very, very sad procession. So we go to watch. So I went to watch. And I went between a paddy wagon and a car, and I came out to the space. And everybody was had ID that was ejected from the bar, and people had started to make a semicircle around the bar. And then I saw the scarf. It was open space. Brutally grabbed this Latina queen. Brutally. I was really surprised. I'd never seen that before. And drag her and bring her to the paddy wagon. And then something happened. It was just a hint that this night was going to be like no other. As he pushed her in, she kicked him on the shoulder. I'll never forget the high heel, silver lame with the paste jewels, pushing him in this amazing strength. And he fell over and he got up and he went into the back of the paddy wagon, and you could hear flesh and bone against metal and moaning. And it's dying moaning as she was losing consciousness. And he came out, brushed his hands, brushed his pants, closed the door, looked at us, and did what they always did. And we were in shock because we couldn't believe the brutality now in the center of everything. What are they trying to show us? We had to think as gay people in the back of our heads, what are they telling us? No, no. And he said to us, and I'll use, you know, excuse me the words, but all right, you fucking faggots. You saw what you saw. Now get out. And that's how it was. We just would turn around and leave because what are you going to do? That's the law. But not that night. He turned around confident to face the bar because we had to, he had issued a command. And we started marching towards him. I don't know what we look like because we just kept marching towards him. And I remember getting very close to him and seeing the hairs on the back of his neck rise. And he turned around and lifted that club to say that command again. And he did not. He blinked, he gulped, he retreated and ran to the bar. And all along the arc, all along the semicircle, there was enough provocation by the police with their derision, you know, and their contempt and the way they conducted these raids like Nazis, that a riot has just formed, and it did form. And it was just crazy. People were looking for pennies because it made a copper and throw it at the bar. But that wasn't it. It was going further. It was just going further. The AGs were very nervous that were in the street, but they were almost pleading with the wilder queens to do something. And everybody wanted to do something. And the list in your head of the people that had been beaten and destroyed by the police and never mentioned again, and you did like and remember, and it all came true. And all everything, kind of summer, they're showing us in the middle of the village they can do this to us, what's next? It was just too much. And everybody wanted to do something, not riot, but do something. And the frenzy became a riot. The small pieces ended up as the bigger picture as a riot. But this was an individual protest, an individual scream, like Munch's scream. It was all too much. What is happening? And for the first time, as the that cop who ran into the bar, they all did. It was like being at Dachau and having your tormentors under your control for a moment. You wouldn't believe how powerful, how complete that feeling can be. And it can lead you to paths you would have never taken. And we took them because it was too much. And we started throwing things in. And it got intelligent, amazing, gay intelligence. Of going to get things to throw, to vent our anger, like orange peels from a shop, a whole big bag of them the queens would drag in, and just to vent that anger. But the only two things that could finish this was blood, our blood or their blood, or if we could vent that anger, and we could not vent that anger. And it got crazier. A riot is a very, very dynamic and thing. It's also kinetic. And you keep moving. New constellation, a new kaleidoscopic view comes in, you move. And then you smell burning flesh and sweat and testosterone you hear broken glass and shouts and whatever's happening ahead of you. And the police coming, and they're breaking through, whatever. And then all of a sudden you stop. The moment of lucidity is incredible. At one point, on top of the window of Stonewall was this queen who was very unliked, who was very poor, very unhealthy, and very, very picked on by the police. And I looked at her, Miss New Orleans, I never forget her name. And I looked at her and she was on fire. I had never seen anything like that except John Brown posters, the abolitionist. She's on fire for freedom, for what? For the moment, I don't know exactly what turned her into that. It wasn't totally revenge. I could see that. There's a humanist to it. But she was on fire. And she jumped down and she grabbed the parking meter and started breaking it. She's pretty skinny, breaking it. And then people realized what she was doing and they helped her and they started battering the barred doors at the peepholes. Well, these contemptuous cops still laughing. And then some queen got lighting fluid from that store, the optimal store. It's in the photograph sometimes. It was always red blade, and poured it all over the door and set it on fire. And they stopped. They stopped laughing. And a heightened nervousness came over their face. They were waiting for the cavalry to come. The cavalry hadn't come. And it was amazing. Of course, we were an inch away from breaking into that bar. And they were an inch away from shooting us. I didn't know that. I'm telling you now because I read that. But something happened. Everything went silent. Completely silent. The worst thing in a riot is silence. And it was this marching sound, the thumping, and the crowd opened, and there was a tactical police force. They sent in the tactical police force to end this riot. They were designed to fight guerrillas, communists, the Black Panthers, militant paramilitary groups. People from El Salvador and Kinshasa in the Congo were sent to them to learn how to end a riot, how to take control, how to deliver the situation they've been asked to do, this mission. And the mission was to stop the gay riot. It was incredible, really incredible. And they thought it was incredible because when they came in front of us, they did not know what to think. And they were in their butch drag. It was just incredible. And we realized something, everybody without a leader, that the whole point was they were going to stop us. So we had to make sure they didn't stop us. And we had to make sure they charged us because we had to know, like your enemy, I think it's called grabbing the belt of your enemy, to know, get close to your enemy just to see how they do things. Very intelligent. But you see, you know, all these beatings we got all the time up to Stonewall, all these attacks on us when we went to movies and we have to meet later. We always wound up meeting later. And there was a hiatus and we'd get to the movies even later. Made us very good urban guerrillas. Who knew that their cruelty would serve us so well that night, and it did. Because we realized we had to make the charge. So we put those obnoxious queens in front of us and they did the kick line. And we are the village girl. We wear our hair and curl. And they couldn't take it. These butch trained gladiators charged. But we knew that ground. We knew the village. They couldn't get us. Sometimes we'd be behind them and say, are you looking for us? And these guys, millions were spent on them. They were vaunted all over the world with training. It's like the West Point of anti-guerrilla training. And the gays acted very, very well. They acted without leadership, by instinct. And two things have to end the riot. You have to vent out or blood has to be spilled. And that's, blood really wasn't spilled. The anger was vented. Morning came. They didn't win. They couldn't catch us, stop us. And it was incredible. It was actually some parts were very funny. We would laugh later on about it. But morning came, I was on the stoop, and there was a queen across another stoop, and she was patting her head and shooting the riot because you could see she was blood. And then 3 feet away from her was the police who wasn't going to arrest her anymore because it was over. And I went home. But before that, the street was ruined. Our street, our turf. So important in the 60s to have a turf. And by the end of the 60s, very late, we had a turf. Our place ruined. And the window broken. And there was debris everywhere. The results of a riot. But the great beauty of all that glass in the street was like a road of diamonds. I couldn't symbolize it as hope then, but I do symbolize it in my heart as hope today, because now I remember that beautiful street. I didn't think so then. I went home, and my father, who was very liberal, cab driver, he owned his own cab for 30 years, he went around and was a very liberal man, and said, it's about time you guys did something. About time. And I didn't say anything. I said, what you can do? And then I knew there was going to be a backlash. There was a conservative element rising. They were physical. They were rising, like SA or SS people. And they were the hard hats, they were called. They were construction workers. They were beating up the hippies. But they were also beating up all dissidents, especially uppity fags that were going places where they shouldn't be, you know, to a park or something.
How did that energy from that weekend propel forward for a year to the very first Pride? Did you have to talk about it? Did everyone just know they were going to have a celebration on the anniversary?
Gay pride then meant that you had pride in yourself and you happened to be gay. Mm-hmm. I think you understand that. It was like a vanity. And thank heaven for it all, because these made very great, powerful swings. Mm-hmm. And because the confidence and consensual pride of later comes with the year, that first Pride March, which is my favorite moment in gay history. Because, you know, Stonewall, well, Christopher Street in 1969, right after the riot, became as politically active as Moscow must have been in 1917 or Paris in 1789. Now, these people couldn't have thought this overnight. This couldn't happen between June 27th, you know, and June 30th. Everybody had to have been thinking about this. And there were riots all over the country. And it wasn't because New York was the most advanced people and futurist, whatever. All it meant is that New York was the place where it was filmed. And in the center of the city, the press was there. And there was a vague emptiness to the day, and that filled the news. And that's what it was. It was everywhere, this desire to end this, and not to be free, not to have rights, not to marry, not to, just stop it. Just stop the persecution. It's all anybody has. You could think the way you want to think and feel sorry for us, and all the terrible things you say, oh, fine, but just stop the persecution. To go to Coney Island to enjoy your day and to wander bloody, because you had confidence in a friend and you spoke in a gay language, and they overheard you. Oh, could you imagine?
You say that the year after was your favorite moment in Pride history. What was that like?
It was great. They said, there's going to be a march, 1970. And the hard hats were out, you know, constructors beating up the hippies and dissidents. But it was very, very scary. And they said, it's going to be a march. Right? Everyone I saw said, oh, I'm going to be at the march tomorrow. I'm going to be at the march. And we're supposed to march in Washington Square Park. And I wouldn't know, you know, things were getting a little bit hairy. And I watched this show, National Geographic, about wildebeest. And I noticed that the ones on the ends were the ones the crocodiles got. So I called my friend Bertie and said, let's march. But what we'll do is march in the middle. And Bertie said, that's very clever. I said, good. And we went down, and there was nobody in the park hardly. And the guy with the board comes over and says, all right, we're ready for the first run. And I said, run? He said, well, this is all there is, and there may be some trouble, so just walk quickly. I could not believe it. I had to walk, and 6 feet away was Bertie behind me, and we were walking up, not Fifth Avenue with dignity, but a little piece of Sixth Avenue without dignity. Well, the march started, and I was in it, and what more could I do? And we started marching, and where were the gays? Well, they all had heard about it, you know. Great part, it was amazing. Quick. And there they were, all online watching us. I couldn't believe it. It's a shame. At least, I kept walking, but they couldn't handle it. Somehow they couldn't handle it. You could see them struggling with their faces. You could see them starting to jump the police lines. You could see them starting to join us. And then a woman, she joined us with her kids. She's something about, you're right. And then this priest who turned his collar around. And he came in. Someone said, I'm adopted. And then gays that you didn't like, you know, that you wouldn't really deal with, you know, this is the beginning of gay pride, you know, what linked, you know, I saw somebody there, you know, that was a gay. He was beautiful. And then I said to Bertie, we're in the middle. We're in the middle. They were joining. It was really happening. And we got to Central Park. And there we stopped. And I told this police officer, I said, so now I know. I said, you had to stop it. You had to. He said, oh no, he said, there's too many of you. You're gonna have to wait to get into the bar. And there it was, multitudes of gay people. I remember between 14 and 16 riding the bus every night just to look at gay people who had friends, people who they had friends, they had people they had said hello to. There were other people out there. How did they get to that point? Here they were in multitudes all over Central Park South. At the top of one hill, in these colorful outfits of the time, the 60s, stood this queen. She stood out at the top of the hill. It was very dramatic. I did like it a lot. And she used her hands as wings. She became a bird into this modern dance. I finally understood modern dance. I guess it has to be good, because she was good. And it's represented freedom. And everybody was holding on to each other, kind of gays that I don't think would have done that a year before. It was my favorite moment in all gay history. What began as a question mark in Russian Square Park and terrible fear ended as an exclamation point in Central Park with all of my joy and a real sense of pride. Now there really was, there was pride.
Yeah, that's wow. That I'm getting a little bit emotional hearing that because I remember what it was like to grow up and to come into city bigger cities and see people who looked how I felt and see them with their friends and I get to be that person for someone. And Chris gets to be that person for someone. Chris was that person for me for a while. And Martin, I know that you're also really involved in a lot of the stuff happening with Marsha Beach. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the exact story is they wanted a beach. An interesting idea, man. The beach is to be like a gay beach where Christmas Street ends, really. And the trans queens feel that this is going to be very like one white Wonder Bread beach. You know, it's up to who's going to occupy that beach, you know, and what facilities will make it a beach for everybody or an exclusive beach hidden under the idea of this is, I mean, this has to be this way. And they called me and they watched my. They had watched me on documentaries. They thought I looked sensible and asked me to help try to change this idea of the beach. I don't know if they want to keep the beach or not. I don't really care. But to name the area for Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera, and of course I would, you know. I mean, I knew Marsha. I didn't know Sylvia, but one of my regrets was not knowing Sylvia. But I did know Marsha, and yes, yeah, they should be honored. And I'm really going to help these people. and do the best I can. I'm going to try to develop my speech skills. I'm going to try. I've been effective sometimes before. You can feel it when you are. You know, I'm just going to go out there. I'm going to be out there for the girls. Let's put that right.
We love to hear that. Absolutely.
Yes, we do.
I think you're doing a great job. And I know that you are traveling with the International Day of Pink. And they're the ones who arranged our conversation today. How are those speaking engagements going? They're going very well.
It's good. Very interesting. At one point, they were like 10 years old. Oh, I felt like Mr. Garrison from South Park. It was too much. But I just explained to them about bullyism.
Yeah.
Would you imagine you're not going to get out of school? The bullying is not going to stop. It's going to go on. Yeah. And they were like, yeah, they understood that. So, yeah, no, it's really, I've been learning about Canada and learning about this kind of general hospitality in this country. It's very, very high level. Very high level.
We try.
I'm from New York. I know what it is. I know what it isn't. I mean, I live there in New York. So anyway, thank you, Canada. And, you know, it's been a wonderful experience. The bars I went to, it was interesting. It's just as interesting.
Yeah.
It's interesting to spread this word that we really do share, this word of freedom, of compassion, and not sympathy, but empathy, you know.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing to see it all over, maybe because the internet has made us all more closer. I'm all the more for it because, you know, we're all connected now.
Yeah.
Yes, and I'm very glad to see this. I think the Canadian trip has been very, very successful. And I think, you know, well, we have a battle ahead of us. I know us in the United States, you know that we do have a battle. It's on now. It's right on now.
Yeah.
And you may have one in Canada. Who knows? I hope, you know, you escape this. But you'll be spectators of one thing or the other. You're not really spectators when you're gay. You're really involved. So we'll see what happens in the United States. I myself am not too fearful. I've been pushed into the corner before. You know, it takes more than that to kill you. I don't think that's going to happen. So we'll see what happens. And I'm going to continue fighting. And I know that, well, you know, there is an expression in the Quran, a great, great book. You know, it's a great book that translates that whoever builds the spider's house builds the weakest house of all because it's built in the house of another. And I think gay people, no matter where we are, you know, British Columbia or Cairo, doesn't matter. Nobody wants to build the spider's house anymore. Whoever.
We want our own space.
Yes, exactly.
Absolutely.
That's beautiful. I think that interview went very well. I think that I learned quite a bit, and I actually don't think that I realized what Stonewall was fully until I listened to Martin talking.
I also don't think I knew exactly kind of what the energy was. And it's really great to hear from Martin about the real stories of Pride, because I think we all have a very commercialized idea of what the Pride riots were. And so I'm very glad we got to have this conversation today.
Yeah, it's really, really cool to see the origins of why we do this and what we're doing this for, because the fight isn't over. And as Martin said, we're ready and we're gonna continue the fight. We're gonna be here.
So, absolutely.
Love that. Well, thank you so much to Martin Boyce for having this conversation with us.
Thank you so much for sharing your story and your experience with us. And we're really grateful that the Day of Pink and the American Embassy was able to get you to Canada to do some tours.
Thank you to International Day of Pink for arranging this chat and also for sponsoring us. And as well, we'd like to thank the American Embassy for sponsoring this episode as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Ah, beautiful. On next week's episode, we're going to be talking to Glad Day Bookshop in a continuation of our Pride series. Stay tuned.
Bye.
Bye.